Hey everyone, and welcome to the 10th series of Shade Podcast. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Tiana Nakia McLodden, a visual artist, filmmaker, and curator, whose work has been shown at MoMA New York, The Shed, and Kunsthalle Basel, among others. Tiana earned the Buxbaum Prize following the presentation of her video piece entitled I Prayed to the Wrong God for You at the 2019 Whitney Biennial. Her first solo show in the UK, entitled A Mercy Dummy, is currently showing at the White Cube Gallery in Bermondsey, London. And today we'll be delving into the conceptualizations and the literary influences on Tiana's work. And I really hope that you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Thank you, Tiana, so much for coming onto the show and for talking with me. And I want to talk about the experience that I had at your show that's currently showing at the White Cube in Bermondsey in London. But I'd like to start us off perhaps hearing a little bit about your practice, your artistic practice, and where you are now. As I said, you currently have this show. It's called A Mercy Dummy, which presents two bodies of your installation works, exploring ideas of violence, submission, and human endurance. And this was a very moving show for me for many reasons, mostly because it brought up a familiar feeling of tension, but feeling extremely relaxed and comforted at the same time. And that's something that I couldn't quite process or understand, but I felt very much. And I welcomed the kind of reflection of that feeling as I was present with the works, particularly A Mercy. And I enjoyed that recognition of that feeling without perhaps understanding it. But I'd like to just hear from you about this exhibition.
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge moment for me. For many reasons, it's like my debut solo exhibition in the UK, London specifically. And I think it's my biggest commercial gallery presentation. I have I exist as oddly an artist who's had more perhaps museum presentations than gallery presentations. And partly to do with having this very tense relationship with the commercial scene. And being more interested in how my work is handled, you know, and connecting and vibing with curators. To give a background of how I arrived to this moment, I first started off as a filmmaker with no real solid interest in a visual arts practice outside of just visiting museums. That came much later in my life than the average person, I think, after meeting so many people who grew up around museums and things. I grew up in the South, specifically South Carolina. So I don't really go to my first proper museum until I'm in my 20s. The other museums that I go to are more space planetarium and science center type things, but not a museum that holds visual arts. Another part of my origin comes from a severe and very serious and rigorous interest in practice and reading books as a kid, which created this kind of parallel for visual making that I embarked on. So I'm an artist that left a career because I actually advanced and was able to get a career going in the film scene, put out a couple of films of my own that were pretty successful and just kind of decided to leave because I hit a ceiling around my own capacity for the business and the industry at the time. This is 2008 or so. But then also thinking very much about wanting to create a visual experience that people could walk around in, that I could walk around in, and that one could enter at any point of the narrative or whatever was presented in a room. It got very constricted, a constrictive space for me to sit in these film festivals over and over, sit in a movie theater and just see films that are just back to back. The experience was kind of jarring for my brain. And so, left and embarked on a proper filmmaking practice. And I went full all in on that probably around 2012. So I'm almost just shy of this 10-year anniversary of kind of formally leaving that track, investing in this visual arts practice, and then oddly facing going back into making films, but not leaving this visual arts practice. So, and I say that to just preface where I'm at, because I think this show is probably the most current presentation of literally where I'm at, what I'm thinking about in the ways of dealing with space and creating a kind of time-based engagement with space, whether it's like with objects or narrative type elements, and kind of like pulling and playing at these ideas of suspension of disbelief.
That's very interesting to hear about your film practice now. I'm thinking of the marriage between the sound and the visual in this exhibition, like was so prominent. And now I'm understanding the importance of that for you, like bearing in mind your background in film. But in the first room of your exhibition, and this is for listeners who perhaps have yet had to have the chance to visit the show, we are greeted by these huge metal devices, almost floor to ceiling. They're attached to the walls and painted. These devices are steel head gates, which are used to restrain and direct livestock ahead of slaughter. And these form part of the series entitled A Mercy. And regarding these works, you've referenced Temple Grandin. For the listeners who haven't met the work of Temple Grandin, she's a prominent animal behaviorist and has advocated for the more humane treatment of livestock. Grandin is also autistic and an autism activist. And you also reference the writings of Toni Morrison, whose book Mercy lends its title to the work on display. And I'm really interested in the interconnectedness of these references.
So my interest in the device, or what people see in London, the series of Mercy, actually starts for me a little further back. So in 2019, I present my first ever commercial solo show in New York. And it's called Hold On, Let Me Take the Safety Off. And in that show, there is a full cattle chute that is used to actually basically restrain the entire body of the animal. So it's this device and this structure that I basically set in the middle of a gallery surrounded by these leather paintings and objects on a fourth floor gallery in New York. And so it was a very startling, I think, visual for many people who may not know the architecture of the object. You know, it's something that I grew up seeing, but didn't really like reconcile this relationship to until I had, of course, seen the Temple Grandin fiction film that came out, I think it's around like 2010, maybe or so. They had Claire Danes, and she portrayed this fictional account of Temple Grandin. The center of that film kind of arrives at this point for me where I'm also about a decade into kind of like my own private awareness of my own like diagnosis, or what I would say a pre-diagnosis. So I actually am an adult who got diagnosed with ASD, autism spectrum disorder. My diagnosis came in 2019. So this date coincided with this presentation, because when I saw that film, it was the first time that I saw an adult being presented who also had like autism. At that point, I wasn't formally diagnosed, but kind of carried this information that I had been like suppressing. I suppressed for almost 10, 20 years up until my diagnosis about possibly being on the spectrum. And it came originally at a time where I had minimal resources. I had gone to a therapist in college in 2001. And they told me that I may be on the spectrum. I didn't know what that meant. The internet was still shoddy, and I just couldn't wrap my head around it. So, like, you know, for almost 20 years, I kind of held that. And then when I got the funds to actually seek that diagnosis, because I'm like I guess, you know, formally diagnosed through a particular, like, center that can do this, which is few and far in between, that diagnosis really opened up a certain kind of, like, I think it was a very huge conjecture for me, because something that you hold inside of yourself becomes very real when you can read, oddly, this like report that's delivered on you, graphics, all this stuff that was wildly without any kind of awareness for myself. It actually helped me to read and to understand and almost like stand out of myself and see myself figured in this way. So with that, I actually took it and I still kept it to myself, and I decided to produce a body of work around that experience and my relationship to like what it meant to have ASD as this almost like fugitive kind of disorder as it exists. It's hard to explain. It changes per person, but then there's also these similarities. And so that presentation allowed me to get to the material and the object that I was interested in, which are these devices. The cattle chute head gate is featured within the film and also outside of the film to get away from this fiction thing. the reality of how Grandin uses that device comes from her relationship to the animal once she sees the actual like cattle within the device. The device basically creates a compression on the sides and a restraint of the head, and it causes the animal to completely become docile in a state of huge distress. Grandin first saw that and wanted that feeling for herself, and she creates a smaller device that mimics that pressure for her own body to stop a lot of sensory overstimulation. And so for her, that starts this hyper investment in the study of livestock and compassionate slaughter. So the device is for two things. It's for both inoculation, when a cow has to be, you know, vaccinated or studied or branded even, and also slaughter. It calms the animal down. So it has this range within it, but all of it is became something that to me started to represent a psychological landscape of a desire for something that is able to deliver a sensation of safety, but is inherently false. So I was very interested in that tension and the like kind of like falseness behind that. Fast forward to, from 2019 to 2023, last year, I presented as a part of my solo exhibition at the Kunsthalle Basel. I first presented the head gates, which are separate from the cattle chute, on their own as these like almost like painting objects that sit on the wall. The head gate became very interesting to me as an object to pursue because that is the object that has a severity in its difference. It has a difference that's based usually around the center front cavity, which is to apply pressure on the neck or to restrain the animal from entering or exiting. And so I was very fascinated by that, and it led me to thinking about mercy that can be found within an object that does the same thing. And so that show was very much, it featured all American head gates, produced head gates. And I was very focused on the bend, or like what I would consider this bend area, which is supposed to facilitate the cradling of a neck and the severity of the range of that. So the works that are in a mercy, the presentation that is at White Cube in that room, are all sourced from the UK and Europe. Because I didn't want to come in, because I am, born and raised in America. I didn't want to come in as this American artist with these American objects. Because I think over my time and like spending over the past year kind of going back and forth to London, researching and figuring out what I wanted to do, one of the main conversations that will come up is this idea of difference between like the Londoner or the UK born person to America. I decided that I wanted to do a continuation of those head gates because I wasn't done with the series. And I tend to engage with series that have a finite end. There's only so many head gates. So this series is going to end very soon in a couple of years. But the use of those gates were very important because I'm like, when I started to think about and see what head gates existed in the UK and Europe, there was a situation where there were, quite frankly, the same thing, but they actually exhibit very little mercy in their presentation. And so that's what those head gates are. And the head gates, again, it just drives home a certain kind of understanding of an object that can sit within the same structure, but has difference that can suggest a heightened sense of brutality or a lower sense of brutality. But the common denominator is brutality nonetheless, right? There's also the interest that I wanted with the object for it to be a confrontational figure. It's almost the size of a human. And I'm not trying to suggest that a human is, to be engaging with this object as like, cattle at all. My interest is, what do you identify with? Victim, executioner, cattle, hand that delivers this device. Do you have a sensation or a desire to touch the object? What does it do to you physically? Because most of it, for me, is about this kind of sense engagement and an internal kind of wrestling with a power dynamic of like domination and submission. And the last thing I'll say is that I think that it speaks to larger issues around society, the individual, where they stand, where they feel, like if you feel like you're in a system that you can't get out of. With Grandin, all of her papers, her research that I've studied over the years have dealt with how to refine this system. But there is nothing about eradicating the system, because the system is just inherently embedded in the fabric of many, many countries. I think, like, to jump over to, like, bringing in Toni Morrison, who is the source of the name, the whole book is a study on mercy. The book is a complication of ideas around dominion, the study of, like, ideas of catechism and structures that, like, you work within. It is a book that kind of addresses, in a way, and it's different from the larger aspect of her practice of writing. It's a book that deals with land as character. It deals with the earlier years of colonialism in America, pre-race or racism, and how that starts to develop. Partly that's due to religion, partly that's due to capitalism, and then also through the mimicry of what people feel like they should do, despite what they want to do. And so in the show, the voice that you hear, Noma Dumezweni, UK actress, she just basically delivers three lines that are in order in the last chapter. There is no protection. Understand me, there is no protection, and there's nothing in the catechism to tell them no. And there is no protection, but there is difference. And that voice, I want it to be something that startled, but immediately settles you down. Like when you share your experience in the space of this relationship to tension and calm and this thing, I wanted the room to do that to your body in the same way that this, like, head gate delivers that to an animal.
So that arresting nature is interesting because, of course, that mimics perhaps what the cattle might be feeling.
Yeah, and it also mimics what I feel every day as someone who deals with sensory-based issues. You know, every day it's rolling the dice. I don't know what is going to affect me. And sometimes those things can affect me to the point where I can't really function. To do this work, I took notes on myself as well of, like, what are these moments? What are these things? And one of the things that I have done, which I've, like, done a work with, is that I've worn, like, leather straps underneath my, like, clothing to create this sensation of, like, being held and bound together to counter a lot of the offensive, like, kind of information that comes in and hits my body in a certain way. So that space was like, how can I do it in an elegant setting? Because I'm not interested in provocation, but I am interested in how sound can function as this, like, kind of non-consensual kind of engagement that, like, kind of violates.
I'm going to be thinking about that for quite some time. Thank you so much for sharing the background of that. And then after that experience, I walk in to the second room within the exhibition, and I was greeted by a blue dummy figure in a slouched pose in the corner of a darkened room. And this work is entitled Dummy, and it's an immersive installation in the form of a one-act play. And this dummy was illuminated almost like a screen siren of, like, the silent movies would kind of be illuminated on stage. You know, this dummy is under the spotlight. And this piece is also accompanied by a sound work, which was so enveloping. I found this work especially intimate and also comforting. And I was surprised that I felt so connected with this inanimate object, like, instantly. And I also enjoyed how the juxtaposition of the two bodies of work, A Mercy and Dummy, were being presented alongside each other. And so I'd love to hear a little bit about the impulse that you had to present those two works and also about your choice of presenting them together.
Dummy is probably one of my most personal works so far. It was something that I knew had to happen because I think it gave me more of a natural opportunity to really deal with what I felt London actually gave to me. Because when I do a show, I'm always considering where I am. If it's a production of new work, I'm kind of thinking about where I am, like, physically. And also if it's something that has been able to, like, influence me, I'm always interested in wrestling with that. Not to, like, kind of try to even kind of placate an audience or deal with certain kind of elements of legibility. But I think that it's been a challenge for me to really be accountable to what the stakes are, you know, with me in a certain place. And I think that being in London over the past year, the thing that I started to take in the most was theater, because I've always been a fan. Like, theater came up, London theater specifically came up as an important space to be aware of as a filmmaker, especially in the set that I was involved in, like independent like more like experimental filmmakers, because that's where an actor would go to get their chops. Like, you know, everybody knew, like, if you would have wanted to be a good actor in America, you actually need to go over to London for a bit and get with the theater scene. And so my best friend is an actress. Her name is Danielle Detweiler, and she's performed in a lot of films as well as plays. And we've been friends for over 20 years. And she had said casually to me that I should consider making a play, because she knew that I was leaning back into my film practice by embarking on a feature film. I really just was like, okay. I understood why she said it to me. And I really took it serious in a way that I don't think she even expected. So I started to go to all these plays. And I was very interested in trying to approach this in a way that made sense to me. And so I was also reading, while I'm reading through all these texts, specifically doing this reread of A Mercy, I started to go through my interest in Jean Genet. And I had started to read his plays. I got to The Blacks, a Clown Show. And I was just like, almost like startled by the content. I had never really heard of the play. And I read it the first round and I did not like it. And I was like, this could not be put forth today. Today's audience, I was like, it doesn't work. But I understood the timing with all the Black actors that were included in the play. But I went back and started to reread it again and saw this prompt that he wrote about the idea that this is, you know, stating and being very clear, this is a play written by a white man for a white audience about Black people. A white figure should always have a light on them in the audience as a part of the play. If Black members come into the play, they should have to wear a white mask. If the Blacks refuse the mask, let a dummy be used. And I was like, oh, dummies forever. Like, I was like, there will never be an instance where I would ever perform whiteness to satisfy the conceptual framework of a satirical play about Black people. And there's no way. The way my brain works, I went really far and deep. I went and bought this very expensive vintage dummy from the 1930s. It took me like 3 hours to go get it. And I set it in my studio. And I had this idea of like violence in relationship to this object. The dummy that I got is a grappling dummy that's a representative of a figure. It's a dummy that's used to encourage and increase a human's ability to wrestle or to, like, you know, kind of fight or to develop a certain kind of ability of handling another figure's body in a way that won't exhaust a human's body. And so with the figure, instead of going into the violent route after sitting with it for, you know, some time, I decided that, or I felt an immense empathy towards the object. I was like, this object is not, you know, of any use without like this desire for violence. If you don't desire the violence, it's not a violent object. It's not an object to absorb this violence. So then what would the interiority of a dummy be? What would my dummy be? You know, what would the voice of the dummy be that is a representation of my emotions? Could we get away from the figure? What if we had a dummy for our emotional state? And so I started to write around that and created a one-act play that dealt with just the monologue of the dummy, a dummy that's kind of like a representational figure of myself in three different emotional states. And the dummies for the three that I have at White Cube all perform the same monologue, but they just perform it in different emotional styles. So we have melancholic restraint, wounded rage, and defiant pride. Melancholic restraint was the one that I chose because that's what felt where that's where I felt the most current. Like, it's how I feel now. Like, you know, there's a lot going on in the world, but there's also this like restraint element where I'm keeping a lot to myself because I need to survive in the world right now. And so the other part to highlight is that because it is a play, because I was in London, I wanted to work with the best that I could work with to kind of give voice to it. And I reached out to Sophia Fonedo. It was a big ask, but I was like, I'm going for the best. Luckily, she was interested. And I knew it was a weird request because she's a physical and a brilliant, like, visual actress. But I was like, I'm asking for voice. And she gave it up. The last thing I'll say is that, you know, the positioning of the room, some of the elements and the cues is that, again, I'm pushing forth this kind of control and manipulation of the audience a bit, I had them build that space to my directions because I wanted it to be a theater. The floor, as soon as you enter the room, you're on the stage. You know, the floor is marley. It's the same thing that's on the stages. Surrounded are these paintings, these leather paintings that are made of white grease paint to mimic and call attention to that kind of extension of whiteness, that starkness that's used to kind of accentuate whiteness on the stage. The masks are a reference to the court that's featured within the play. And the dummy that's in the corner, that representational figure, it's 110% me. You know, it's like under the light, backed up in a corner. And it's like the first thing, you know, that I wrote was like, if you're looking for a show, it's not here. You know, almost a taunt to audience and also like, you know, call attention to the reality of ideas of performance and, you know, blackness and body and all these other things. So that's what I really want to go, you know, go for, is to push the idea of, could I make a play without any black figure, with any kind of movement? And what can I get into interiority? But also, can I talk about the violence of like surveillance and, you know, being under a certain kind of gaze? But that brings me to the point of like, you know, why these two exist together is like, these are two things that were happening at the same time. These are two things that I was thinking about at the same time, because I knew that I also could show something that makes you complicit, but you're not there, right? Like, we don't really work without you. Like, and then the sense is like, the head gates have, those head gates are functional. If someone were to go pull that lever and that handle, it's going to move. Like, it's not for play. It's not a cute presentation. You know, the dummy and the liveness of it, it's something that is there. It's constantly, unendingly performing, whether it is talking or not. It is a durational performance, right? And so, and it's for you. It's for you. It's almost like violent in its performance. And so like that opportunity for me was massive to think and to have these two sustained feelings that I have in the space exist as a counter to each other, right across from each other. I had the doors placed right across from each other. It's like, choose your adventure. Either way, you're going into some shit, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Everybody. Everybody listening, I encourage you to enter these experiences because they're certainly going to be a memorable one. But lastly, I just would like to hear how it is for you sharing your interiority with strangers.
It's raw, but it's also like the thing itself. I mean, I think that I'm kind of perhaps even edging myself in a way, because that's what it's always felt. Whatever I put up, you put these things up and you leave them, and people, you know, kind of will tear them apart, which therefore, depending on how deep you go, could be tearing you apart. And when people look at them, which is also a form of like looking at you. And so I think there's an element of accountability. I think I felt more at ease with the stand-in because I was like, the dummies are a stand-in. Like, I'm not available, like, you know, for people to run up on, but feel free to run up on the dummy. You know what I mean? Like, it's felt like refreshing and new and a different way to think about my interest in performance, but not being interested in performing, you know? Like, yeah, because I do have all these interests and I've dealt with performance in my practice and a lot of very interesting ways that deal with someone, a figure that's there or not there. It also feels like a way to relieve the body, you know, like my physical body in a very particular way. So it's been a vulnerable experience. It's one that I purposely did to kind of get an idea of the sensation, which I think will feed other kind of projects that I have coming up, which is something I tend to do. So it's very much alive for me. You know, the performance is like, it's alive and it's durational and I get to hear feedback and I am not divorcing, you know, the objects or these presentations from the reality of where I am now.
Thank you, Tiona, for that great conversation and to all of you for listening today. It was so great to hear more about the creativity and the social and literary considerations that underpin Tiona's artistic practice. You can learn more about Tiona's work by visiting her artist page on the White Cube website. And I encourage you to attend her talk happening this evening at the White Cube in Bermondsey. Subscribe to Shade Podcast to listen to all the episodes in this series. Also explore Shade Art Review on Substack, joining thousands of art-curious listeners like you who are discovering more about the work of visual artists from the Black diaspora. There you'll find art listings, comment, artist spotlights and guest posts, and free subscriptions are available. But for the full Shade Art Review experience, sign up today to receive 20% off your annual membership, an offer which is available for the duration of this series. This series of Shade Podcasts was produced and hosted by me, Lou Mensah, and mixed by Tess Davidson. See you next time.